Hello, and welcome to episode 87 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Lee Middleditch of Counsel with McGuire Woods, Vice President of McGuire Woods Consulting, co-founder of the Sorensen Institute at the University of Virginia, and former Board of Visitors member at the University of Virginia. Lee, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Excellent. The first thing I'd like to ask you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done, to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, I'll give you the current interest that I have, and I'm responding to one of your mission statements. I'm a board member of an organization called Charlottesville Tomorrow, which is involved with the presentation of facts in the Charlottesville area for citizenry input to determine whether they wish to be for or against proposals for water changes, as an example, and land use changes. And Charlottesville Tomorrow is a substitute for print media. It's handled electronically, but we support two reporters who serve with the local newspaper, the Charlottesville Daily Progress, one of whom is devoted to education issues and the other to general land use issues.
Interesting. So you started an investigative journalism arm of a local newspaper.
Well, I was not one of the founders, but I am a current board member.
Interesting. And why did you decide to get involved in that? I know you're involved in many things. You're interested in redistricting reform. Why, of all the many different things pulling your attention, were you interested in supporting investigative journalism in Charlottesville?
The local newspaper did not have the ability to do a lot of investigative journalism, and so Charlottesville Tomorrow was an opportunity to approach it in a different fashion through electronic media rather than print media.
Interesting. And so you wanted to help, you saw an opportunity to help transition from print media to electronic media, and that is something that you wanted to get involved in.
I wouldn't be quite so precise in terms of the transition, but Charlottesville Tomorrow as a organization does, I believe, contribute materially to issues that the citizenry in our area are interested in.
And so, Lee, you have had a long career in law, and you have subsequently gotten involved in a number of philanthropies. I'm interested in just going back to the beginning, if we could, and speak about where your interest in law originated from, and then move from there about how the path that your career ultimately has taken.
Well, I was in the regular Navy on a small ship, and I was sent to Naval Justice School in Rhode Island. And when I completed that course, I came back, and I was responsible for court-martials and so forth. And that's what got me interested in law. Then I came to the University of Virginia after I got out of the Navy, and then worked for a state senator who was also the commanding officer of my Naval Reserve unit, and started off with him both during law school and when I graduated. My graduation salary, I think, was $220 a month, which is probably the going wage in Charlottesville for young people at that time. And then 18 months later, moved over to my now firm, which was called Perkins, Battle, and Minor, the predecessor to McGuire Woods, a remarkable organization composed of the former governor of the state of Virginia, John Stuart Battle, his two sons, one of whom became the ambassador to Australia through P.T. Boat experience with Mr. Kennedy, and another law school professor by the name of Mortimer Kaplan, who became the Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service.
Sure.
And it was in days when lawyers could not advertise. So
there was a law prohibiting lawyers from advertising?
Well, it was an ethics issue. And as a result, we were encouraged to get involved in civic organizations because that was a way to project your image.
And drum up business.
And drum up business.
So, well, just for a moment, you said you had a commanding officer who was also a state senator who was your employer. So he was a supervisor two times over for a year and a half, is that correct?
Actually, through the 3 years of law school and then for a year and a half later, he later became our federal district court judge. But that got me interested in politics, and I've had that interest ever since.
So you became interested in politics initially because you had taken a route through the Navy, and then you ended up entering law school as a result of the training in the Navy, and this commanding officer of yours became involved in politics and kind of brought you along.
Is
that
correct?
Just kind of the course of... But what is the nature of your... Have you remained active politically?
I'm an independent voter, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I have no credibility whatsoever. that cachet, if you will, has given me an entree into a number of quasi-political organizations, not the formal Republicans and Democrats. But, for instance, my redistricting effort is called ONE Virginia 2021, and we're trying to convince the Virginia General Assembly to establish an independent commission to draw the legislative lines rather than the current system where at each decennial census the party in power draws the lines to protect incumbents, ergo you don't have much competition. We're trying to change that. We've got 33,000 supporters in Virginia to date, and it's an effort to try to convince the legislators that they should adopt a different procedure.
And why might that be in the public interest?
If you assume, and I think this is roughly correct, that at the last general election in Virginia, there were some 200 legislators up for vote, and there were only 12 or 13 that had contested contests because the rest were all gerrymandered and had safe seats. And we think that's wrong. We think that politics should have reasonable competition to have it produce different people. And politics is such a tough trade, and I'll transition now to the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. We've been underway for a dozen years. We've had over 1,000 people go through the program. It has three tranches to it. Ethics in politics, Virginia issues, and how you get elected. And currently we have, of that 1,000 people who've gone through the program, we have 27 members of the General Assembly. We have had mayors of Richmond and Leesburg and city sheriffs and members of the local Board of Supervisors and City Council. So even though the most people have not offered themselves up for public office, they're politically attuned and hopefully will participate in politics at that level.
Before we continue with the Sorensen Institute, just wanted to follow up with the gerrymandering effort that you're involved in. It sounds like one of the things that you think makes a democracy stronger is by presenting voters with real choice at the ballot box. And it sounds like according to the current system where there's gerrymandering, you're under the impression that an uncontested race does not give voters sufficient choice, and therefore there ought to be new districts. I suppose a defender of the current system may argue, well, there is plenty of choice in the Republican or Democratic primary. How would you respond?
Well, I think that's correct, in part, but the issue is that oftentimes there's not even any primary contests because, to be repetitive, the incumbent has such a power base by virtue of the way the lines of his district are drawn.
So you have become passionate about this. Why?
I think it improves this politics in Virginia. I'm very interested in having an informed citizenry, and I hope that people will vote. And transitioning to another interest of mine, I'm on the board of Montpelier James Madison's home near Orange, Virginia, and we've sponsored annual conferences, the last of which involved why millennials are not interested in politics. And we're trying to turn that around also.
So the Montpelier Institute refers to former President James Madison, the fifth president of the United States, and it's in Virginia, and you bring young people there to do Montpelier summits, and they learn about the Constitution. Why is this important, and what relation does it have with creating a more informed citizenry, and to what extent, and how is it addressing the issue you just raised, which is you don't believe millennials are as engaged in public service as you would like to see?
Well, let me back up. The particular program that I just described was held at the National Press Club last spring, and it was not simply Virginia focused, it was national, and we had a number of very interesting young people who were interested in politics who presented their views as to why millennials find it difficult to be politically engaged. I don't know whether that's responsive to your question or not, but after the conference was over, we will continue to try to encourage millennials, particularly using social media. We had Facebook and Instagram representative involved, and social media, of course, is the way that you all now communicate with one another primarily.
So why is it that you feel that you ought to be involved in this process? Why does it matter? Why is it something that you have decided to do with your life? You've been practicing law. You've been engaged in various different civic activities. Why is it important to you to personally try to improve civic engagement, especially among a demographic that is not your own?
Well, that's interesting. I'm 87. As I told you previously, I'm the oldest practicing lawyer in McGuire Woods. They keep me around to show they don't discriminate age-wise. But I have a limited, useful life left to me, and I simply am interested in politics, and I'm very interested in continuing to have Virginia held up as being one of the premier states in terms of people who've come into politics, with a couple of exceptions, and have been exemplars in their leadership.
So, okay, and then you've also taken efforts. Again, you mentioned the Sorensen Institute, which does it accept both Republicans and Democrats?
Definitely, and we try to have a balance in the class. The classes meet once a month from roughly February through November, and the classes are around 34, 35. Equal Republicans, Democrats, and a couple of independents.
Why is it, and what is the consequence of having multiple individuals from different backgrounds and perspectives in a class together, especially considering that 27 of your alum are currently members of the Virginia General Assembly?
Well, the thesis is that you bring people sometimes with diametrically opposed political positions together, and you in particular put them in a setting where they have to argue with one another, and hopefully some camaraderie develops, and ergo you want to have compromise possibilities between those people through having gone through the Sorensen program.
So what are some of the benefits of having Republicans and Democrats sit together in a room and hash out in dialogue issues that they disagree over, as opposed to having Republican senators and Democratic senators in Richmond sit in the same room, which they may call the Senate chamber floor, and debate the same issues? Why is there a different result? Is there a different result, and what accounts for that?
Well, you remember the vignette about Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, opposite parties, and they used to get together and have a beer periodically together. And I think compromise is often developed in a social setting rather than an antagonistic across the table session between people who represent their parties at that session.
So it sounds like you're trying to create productive dialogue by taking individuals out of their partisan element and trying to create a safe social space where they can create, forge friendships?
Yes. I don't want to take this too far because it hasn't gotten laid on completely, but in 2017 we hope to have a program, again sponsored by Montpelier, on reaching across the aisle, where we will have senators and some congresspeople talking about reaching across the aisle in terms of trying to reach compromise.
And so when so many around the country feel that they entrench themselves in partisanship and they feel as though ideological purity is the way to go, why, you know, you seem to be moving in the opposite direction and saying, look, we need compromise, we need to get a half loaf, which is better than no loaf, and not, and why is that important? Why are you seeking, what drives you to be interested in compromise?
Well, today is Tuesday, December the 13th, 2016, and if you just read the local newspapers, Washington papers, you can see the antagonism that is developed by virtue of the last election. And I think if you're an informed citizen, you're very concerned about the future of the country. If there's all this shooting going on, or shouting going on between the parties.
So very simply, why does it why should we want to have an informed citizenry and an active citizenry?
Well, what's the other side of the equation? If you do not have an informed citizenry, demagogues will come along and make their position, enact their position. I think that's absolutely against our democratic principles. The citizens should be involved.
To what extent do you believe we currently have an informed citizenry and an active citizenry?
Well, if you're talking about percentages, I wouldn't be able to do other than guess, but in terms of minority-majority, my guess is that a minority of the people in the United States are not informed citizens when it comes to civic matters.
What are your metrics for what an informed citizen... What does an informed citizen look like?
That's a good question. I guess from my bench position, somebody who reads the Washington Post, at a minimum, I've got the current issue of Politico, which probably is beyond the ken of most readers. Financial Times is an English newspaper that produces a lot of international political news. So an informed citizen would be somebody who is interested in politics and uses the media sources to be apprised of the political issues of the day.
Is it sufficient to be informed, or must one also be active?
Well, you have to start off with information.
Are there any activists who are not informed?
Yes, I think there are.
So,
and I don't want to point fingers at the current crop, but there are certainly people that are firing off of the top of their head without having facts, and that sort of sounds like folks that are not informed.
So it sounds like you would like to have, you've worked hard to create an active, informed citizenry through your work. It says that you just said that an informed citizenry is one that is aware of current events, that accesses current events through multiple periodicals, multiple data sources, international, national, local, and you've put your money where your mouth is, trying to support investigative journalism on the local level. You're trying to create leaders that are willing to compromise and understand others who are different. And that's what you do with the Sorensen Institute. Then you have been working with gerrymandering to stop gerrymandering in Virginia in order to give informed citizens an opportunity to be active in selecting who would represent them in elected office. Is that a fair assessment of...
Yes.
Your interests?
If I can jump shift, I'm having lunch today with the United States ambassador to Zimbabwe, And I've got a distinct interest in Southern Africa. I've done some educational efforts there. And there's an organization called the Mike Campbell Foundation that is trying to help the displaced indigenous farmers, displaced because their employers have been ejected from the farms in Zimbabwe.
You're talking about the country formerly known as Rhodesia,
yes,
where the white owner farmers were ejected from the country by Bob Mugabe.
Correct.
And now you're saying that the black African farmers who had worked for the white African farm owners are in distress.
That's exactly right. And their children have to pay for their schooling. And we've been trying to raise money through this Mike Campbell Foundation to support the tuition of the children of the disadvantaged, displaced black farmers.
Interesting. And why is it that that's an issue that matters to you? Clearly, they're not, those individual farmers living in modern-day Zimbabwe are not going to have any impact on civic life in Charlottesville, Virginia.
That's correct. I've just gotten interested in various issues in Southern Africa, and I did that when I was a lawyer, so I've carried it forward out of my semi-retirement.
And you have an interesting career as a lawyer. You became involved with a law firm that was created by a former governor, a lot of political connections. How was it that you originally even got involved, connected to the former governor and the political elite?
Having started with my lawyer, who was my commanding officer, at $220 a month, I was starving to death with a wife and one child at the time, and I was asked to come across the street by Mortimer Kaplan, who became the commissioner of Internal Revenue Service and was a partner in my now firm for $350 a month. So I went because of the lure of an additional stipend.
Why did he seek you out?
I had done some work in law school, and they ran out of Indians, so they had to find some workers, and I was down the street. So
you were a spare body, and for that, you were given a 50% pay increase.
Almost 50%.
And recruited to work for the law firm of a former governor.
That's correct.
Because you just happened to be at the right place at the right time.
That's exactly correct.
Interesting. To what extent would you attribute your successful career to luck versus to your own efforts?
I think it's 95% luck. If luck is being at the right place at the right time, rather than going to a career path that's plotted out.
So we're nearing the end of this podcast, and I'd like to ask you one last question. You served your country in the U.S. Navy. You continue to contribute of your own volition at your own expense, and you give of your time to these many philanthropies. You continue to help out the law firm. You're very interested in, you help in Southern Africa. You're interested and engaged in making life better for others. You're trying to create a more informed citizenry, which will lead to a more active citizenry, one that values dialogue. What is it about you, about Lee Middleditch, that says, you know, I'm not in it just for me. I'm in it because I'd like to help others as well. What is it that drives you to do public service?
I've never thought of it in that context. I guess I like to organize things, and when an opportunity comes along that looks like I can participate in the organization, that from time to time intrigues me, and I just take off in that direction.
What's your legacy? How do you want to be remembered?
That's interesting. I've written my own obituary, and it's unusual because it's a short form obituary. But I think the two things in the obituary that I want to be remembered for, I was on the Board of Visitors at the University of Virginia, and I think probably a co-founder of the Sorensen Institute was the other.
And the reason that those things matter to you? Because many people have been on the Board of Visitors.
No, not many. I was an undergraduate at the university before I went in the Navy, and I owe the University of Virginia a lot. Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in the honor system, and that's under stress now. So anything I could do to help the university, I would like to do that.
So that has been Lee Middleditch, who speaks about, who does not necessarily see himself as someone who does public service, yet he undoubtedly spends much of his life seeking to make this world better for others. Lee is an individual who has benefited from circumstance and through hard effort has contributed much to those who have not been so fortunate as to benefit from the same circumstances that he has benefited from. Lee has convictions that an honor code at UVA, that fair play, that an informed citizenry that becomes active is important. He believes having a strong connection to the University of Virginia, the first public university in the United States, started by Thomas Jefferson, the same one whose books filled the U.S. Library of Congress, and who said and whose theory was that public education would be the means of informing a citizenry, and only through an informed citizenry and a strong fourth estate, which is journalism, should a people be able to govern themselves. And it seems as though, in this sense, Lee strives to hold up the mantle that has been bequeathed to him by the legacy of Thomas Jefferson. So, Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
And this has been episode 87 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time.